Is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandi Spergotta for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article by Elena Nicolou is titled, Here's What Makes Bollywood Movies So Special. Say the word Hollywood, and images of blockbuster pictures, red carpets, and one very iconic white-lettered sign in the hills of LA are likely conjured. Similarly, Bollywood is known for certain fixtures, like elaborate song and dance sequences, romantic melodrama, and striking set design. But there's so much more to this diverse film industry where those came from. Bollywood, a portmanteau of Hollywood and Bombay, the former name of Mumbai, refers to the Hindu language sector of India's movie-making industry, still based in Mumbai. Bollywood is the largest sector of India's film industry, accounting for a third of movie tickets sold in India in 2020 and 44% of net box office revenue. Producing between 1,500 and 2,000 movies a year across 20 languages, India has the largest film industry in the world. Yes, bigger than Hollywood, in terms of number of films released. Other areas of India's film industry include Tollywood, the Telugu language sector in Hyderabad, and Kollywood, Tamil language sector in Chennai, and others. For context, these are a few of many Hollywood-inspired nicknames around the world. Nollywood refers to Nigeria's film industry. Trollywood is Sweden's, and Yollywood is Atlanta's growing production hub. In recent years, Bollywood has grown to epic proportions, capitalizing on seeds planted more than a century ago, when the first silent Bollywood film was released in 1913 and the first talkie in 1931. Today, Bollywood movies are tremendously popular and well-respected among India's movie-going audiences. Speaking to OprahMag.com, film critic Shubhra Gupta says that when she started reviewing Bollywood movies for the Indian Express 25 years ago, some of her peers would pity her. Poor you, you don't get to see Hollywood movies, she recalls. Then Bollywood became cool. Now Bollywood is the thing. There are so many kinds of movies that are coming out. Everyone wants a piece. It's cool to watch Bollywood now. The popularity of Bollywood movies is reflected statistically, too. Box office revenue in India was estimated to have reached an all-time high of $1.4 billion in 2018, with Hollywood movies only accounting for 10% of ticket sales in India in 2018, though that figure has only grown due to the unprecedented success of Avengers Endgame. Now, though, Bollywood's century-old industry is reaching a new challenge. How to surmount the global pandemic and maintain its growing momentum? At the moment, Bollywood movies are available to watch via streaming, even if they're often best enjoyed in theaters. Here's what you need to know as you begin your own Bollywood cinematic experience. Bollywood movies are known for their song and dance sequences. Indian cinema evolves separately from Hollywood and retains its own characteristics. One of the most striking examples of Bollywood's unique aesthetic are the movie's use of song and dance. The celebrated song and dance sequences of Bollywood show no influence of the Hollywood musical, Sabrina Chiofi writes in the academic paper, Popular Hindi Cinema, Narrative Structures and Points of Continuity with the Tradition. According to Chiofi, this element was borrowed from classical theater, where music, singing, and dancing play an important part. Typically, the music scenes are woven into the narrative plot like small detours from reality. The singing is rarely done by the actors, giving another sense of breaking from the narrative. According to film critic Gupta, who also wrote The 50 Films That Changed Bollywood, 1995 to 2015, song was a way for characters to express their feelings. A song is a space for desire. Things that were not allowed in the public domain, filmmakers would put into a song. The audience knew that this was make-believe, Gupta says, fondly recalling times when fellow moviegoers would dance in the aisles during songs. Now we're all too cool for school. We don't do that stuff in our multiplexes anymore, but back in the day, it's something we very much did, she says. Sarol Khan, one of Bollywood's leading choreographers, passed away in July of 2020. Over the course of her 60-year career, she was behind over 2,000 dances, many of them legendary. She was known for her collaborations with Madhuri Dixit and Sridevi, who died in 2018. As Bollywood movies become more and more realistic, these musical sequences, which featured lip-syncing, have changed too. Something that you used to take for granted no longer happens, someone bursting into song, Gupta says. Instead, a song will usually play in the background of the scene. Music continues to be a fixture of Bollywood movies, however, with songs from films living on as pop hits. An Indian movie without music is an anomaly, Gupta says. Music tells you a story. You could be saying something, but if there's music, you could be adding something to that scene. But Bollywood movies have transformed over the years. The period between the 40s to the 60s is considered the golden age of Hindi cinema. During this time, critically acclaimed movies like Pyaasa and Mother India came out, offering incisive and thought-provoking takes on society. But according to Gupta, many, though not all, Bollywood movies made later in the 20th century were marked by a similar formulaic quality. The hero had to be a really good guy, he couldn't do anything dubious or dodgy. The leading lady had to be completely pure, Gupta tells OprahMag.com. These were the pillars around which everything revolved. Just as the romantic heroes came together at the end, side characters reached similar fates across movies too, with outsized villains and bad girls meeting their fates. A movie that allowed its bad girl to work out without any problems is not to be accepted by the masses, she adds. In recent years, Gupta has noted a shift in Bollywood films toward realism and breaking from formulas. Things have changed to a large extent. Filmmakers veering toward the more natural forms of storytelling, more realistic. People are asking, where's the real story, Gupta says. Even the acting has become more naturalistic, according to Gupta. A lot of the actors in early Bollywood came from Parsi theater tradition. Everything was over-exaggerated. People were throwing their hands around. It's taken us many years to learn the less you do, the more impact it can have on screen, Gupta says. Some stories never get old, though. Devdas, an acclaimed high-budget movie released in 2002 and starring Aishwarya Rai and Shah Rukh Khan, was the third Hindi-language iteration of the movie. Then, in 2009, Anurag Kashyap's groundbreaking and racy Dev.D set the story in modern-day New Delhi. The epic tale has been rendered into other languages, too. Parallel cinema was an alternative to traditional Bollywood cinema. Parallel cinema is a film movement that began among Bengali filmmakers and ran counter to mainstream Bollywood movies in the 60s and 70s. These were groundbreaking and issue-based movies that rebelled against the mainstream mold. No exaggerated acting, no melodrama, no sacrificial best friend, Gupta says, describing the genre. They picked up on themes that were germane to the lives we were leading at that point, which were not addressed at all in mainstream cinema. Take the classic 1974 Hindi-language movie Ankur, which depicts the intersection of class and caste in rural India by following a landlord's son's relationship with a servant. Gupta says that as Bollywood evolves, there's no longer a stark divide between movies. Now it's all part of the Bollywood scene. It's no longer a parallel film and a mainstream film. They're all happening together, Gupta says. For example, Anubhav Sinha's recent movies Thapad 2020 and Article 15 2019 explore domestic violence and how caste functions within the criminal justice system. Bollywood's signature masala movies combine many genres into one. Masala movies are unique to Bollywood, but not all Bollywood movies are classified as masala movies. Essentially, this type of movie, which rose to prominence in the 70s and 80s with films like Chalet, combines a range of genres into one film. It gets its name from the word masala, which means spice in Hindi. You have a bit of everything, some action, some drama, some comedy, some emotion, Gupta says, describing a classic masala movie. You can see it. Here comes the fight scene. Here's the romantic song. For Anucha, a Maryland-born law student who grew up watching Bollywood films, the mix of genres is the defining feature that separates Bollywood and Hollywood. There's a thicker line between action and romance. In Bollywood, we smoosh it all together, she tells OprahMag.com. Simba, out in 2018, is a recent example of a masala movie. However, there are Bollywood movies made in all genres. In the 90s, for example, the outright romance reigned supreme. Some hallmarks of that era include Dilwale Dulhania Le Jayenge, which played in theaters for 23 years, and Hum Dil Da Chuk Sanam. To this day, Bollywood makes more romance movies than Hollywood, according to Live Mint. Also, currently comedies and thrillers are more popular than romances, per Live Mint. Bollywood stars wield their own power. Mumbai's movie industry is dominated by a few key A-listers. The actors Shah Rukh Khan, Salman Khan, and Amir Khan, also known as the Khans of Bollywood, are megastars, coincidentally, all born in the year 1965. Some of the most famous leading ladies include Aishwarya Rai Bachchan, who rose to fame as the winner of the Miss World 1994 pageant, Priyanka Chopra, who married Nick Jonas in 2019, Kareena Kapoor, Deepika Padukone, Madhuri Dixit, Kahol, and more. Now, many of the leading men have their production hubs. For example, Shah Rukh Khan makes movies under his company Red Chillies Entertainment. Salman Khan has Salman Khan Films, or SKF. Akshay Kumar is another powerful actor with his own production house. Nobody can hire them because they're too expensive, so they make their own movies, Gupta says, adding that some women actresses are moving into producing, like Anushka Sharma. However, the recent suicide of a promising young actor, Sushant Singh Rajput, is reigniting debates about nepotism and the uneven distribution of power within Bollywood's star system. A trained engineer turned backup dancer turned breakout star, Rajput's career followed a rags-to-riches trajectory, but he never lost his status as an outsider. Some say it led to his decision to take his own life. Movie Mafia not only banned him, but I can tell you how his mind was systematically dismantled bit by bit, actress Kenyana Ranaut said in an Instagram video per the Associated Press. New to Bollywood? Start with these movies. Clearly, there is an abundance of excellent Bollywood films to watch. The question is, where to start? While we've compiled our own favorites, Gupta provided us with her own list of recommendations, ranging from rom-coms to coming-of-age stories, all available to stream. Some of the movies listed are Monsoon Wedding, The Lunchbox, Dil Chahata Hai, Udaan, Dev D, Death in the Gunj, Anarkali of Ara, Suede's, and Lipstick Under My Burqa. Our next article by Lee Haber is titled Stacey Abrams' novel While Justice Sleeps was rejected by publishers twice. 10 years ago, before Stacey Abrams was a household name and a hero to many, she was an attorney who geeked out on tax law and wrote romance novels on the side. She'd also written a novel about a Supreme Court justice who was quietly amassing evidence about a conspiracy to essentially undermine democracy. When he's found in a coma, it's up to his brilliant law clerk, Avery Keene, to pick up where he left off and save the day. That political thriller was rejected by publishers on two separate occasions. Over a decade later, While Justice Sleeps finally made its way to bookstores across the country. Since penning it, Abrams has served 11 years in the Georgia House of Representatives, including 7 as its minority leader, and ran for governor of her home state in 2018. She's also gone on to become a patron saint of voting rights, credited as a key player in swinging Georgia to the Democratic side in the 2020 election, and helping land President Biden in the White House. Abrams is a Renaissance woman who is not only a writer, activist, and politician, but also sits on the board of the Women's Basketball Association and is a lifetime member of the Council on Foreign Relations. She's the founder of Fair Fight, Fair Count, and the Southern Economic Advancement Project, too. And it turns out she can also write a labyrinthine, pulse-pounding thriller. As Oprah Daily's books editor, I wanted to know, how does she do it? So we had a chat. You wrote While Justice Sleeps 10 years ago, but when you sent it out to publishers, they rejected the book. That didn't happen this time around. I've written 8 other novels and 2 works of nonfiction, which have all gotten published, so I can't complain. This was the only one I'd written that hadn't got published, but I'm delighted that it's finally seeing the light of day. It was a story I just had to get on paper all those years ago, but no one was interested in a thriller by me set in the Supreme Court. This is the only book I've written that no one initially wanted to buy. But a couple of years ago, I was in California talking to producers about my romance novels, and someone asked if I had any other story ideas. When I described While Justice Sleeps to them, they were excited. One thing led to another. Now not only is the book out, but I've also signed a deal with Working Title NBC Universal to executive produce a TV show based on it. It's all worked out. What's your writing process like? The genesis of this book was a conversation I had with Teresa Wynn Rosenborough. She was Assistant U.S. Attorney General under Bill Clinton and is one of the first black women to make partner at Sutherland, a major law firm in Georgia where I was hired to work some years ago. By the way, now Teresa is the general counsel for Home Depot. She's just extraordinary. I was starting out as a tax attorney there, and I also happened to be an author of romance novels, which took some explaining to the firm. Teresa was very supportive of my writing, and I often talked through story ideas with her. Sometime after I left to work in the Georgia House of Representatives, we were having lunch together, and she said, "I've been thinking about something, and I wonder whether this is an idea you'd care about." What was her idea? She asked if I'd ever thought about the fact that while the Constitution provides solutions for what happens if the president or a member of Congress is incapacitated or must be removed from office for whatever reason, there are no such provisions for what to do if a federal judge can no longer perform their job, and that appointment is for life. You can replace federal judges for high crimes and misdemeanors or for being in debt, but not for incapacitation. And you went, "Whoa, that's a great idea for a novel?" It's fascinating. The founders didn't anticipate that the kind of extraordinary measures taken today to extend someone's life would be put into practice. Certainly back then, no one lived for years in a coma. After our lunch, I couldn't stop thinking about that. It became the construct of the story. I had this vision in my head of Howard Wynn, the Supreme Court justice for whom my main character, Avery King, clerks, sitting in a chair, arguing with the fates and nature, knowing he is ill and will soon be unable to function. And after that scene? I need to know what the end will be before I really start writing a book. I'm very methodical. So I crafted a synopsis to tell myself how the story would unfold. That became the bones of the book. Then I did a storyboard and plotted out each chapter. I asked myself what every chapter's problem was and what its solution would be. Especially with thrillers, you have to be aware that if the plot slows, people may put down the book and walk away. So I constructed it in such a way that you have to get to the next page in order to get the answer to the next mini mystery. My storyboards are typically massive walls of post-its, and that was the case here. In exchange for your friend Teresa's idea in the novel, you named the female chief justice after her, right? I did indeed. I think she should be on the Supreme Court anyway. How important is representation in fiction? I write a variety of characters, but I never ignore the importance of identity. I just don't allow it to be used as a defining moment that negates the possibility of experience. I grew up reading fiction. If I was trying to read a thriller, if I was reading a romance novel, the characters were invariably white. And I knew it because the only time they mentioned race explicitly was to tell me that the character they were talking about was black or, say, Hispanic. They would only identify the character by race if their race was not white, which meant that whiteness was universal and everything else was other. And when you're reading fiction, especially when you're reading thrillers, you want to get immersed, to get pulled along with the action. So it's always very jarring to me when all the other characters aren't being identified by race, but a person of color is. So you decided consciously not to do that? I want to write stories where the reader doesn't get thrown out of the story because they don't see themselves. But I also never want to ignore how race and gender affect how we think, how we live, how we engage, though that shouldn't limit us in our capacity for adventure and excitement or the adventures of our mind. You've described writing as cathartic but also demonstrative. What do you mean? I'm in high-pressure positions. I'm in politics. I'm also an entrepreneur. These are spaces where things quickly get very intense and there isn't a lot of relief. So for me, writing is an opportunity to, for example, take out my frustrations. I kill a lot of people in my books. But besides that, it's also an opportunity to work through the way I'm thinking about an issue or the way I conceptualize experiences. It lets me explore other facets of myself. What do you hope your fictional characters will communicate to readers? When you're crafting characters, you're crafting people, and they should be so distinct that without having their names on a page, anyone could read the dialogue by itself and know who's talking. That's my test. In my day job, I need to appreciate the uniqueness of every person I serve. It's the same in fiction. It's important to comprehend the interconnection of our lives and the challenges we all face. And to realize that that connectedness does not require uniformity, it requires understanding. Last question, how does it feel to be nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize? It is an extraordinary honor, though something I feel very unworthy of. In saying that, I'm not trying to diminish the work I've done or its impact, but there are many other things being accomplished all over the world by many others, and I'm acutely aware of that. Our next article by Elena Nicolou is titled, "The Full Moon Offers a Time for Forgiveness and Making Amends According to Astrologers." Popular legend has it that the full moon brings all our emotions, good and bad, to the surface. In fact, the word lunatic comes from the belief that lunar phases cause temporary insanity. Superstitions persist to this day, including the myth that full moons cause aggression and an increase in emergency room visits. According to astrologers, the full moon might indeed be a time of heightened emotion. Yasmin Boland, astrologer and author of the book Moonology, explains why. Every 28 days or so, the sun, which represents the ego in astrology, and moon, which represents the inner self, are aligned on opposite sides of the earth, resulting in the full moon. Because the sun and the moon are as far apart as they can get during the full moon, it's like your ego and feelings are separate. You can actually deal with your emotions without your ego getting in the way, Boland explains. Whereas the new moon is a chance to set intentions for the cycle ahead, the full moon encourages us to let go. It's about making amends and forgiveness, Boland explains. Through full moon rituals, we can harness the moment's energy to release burdens. In the time before the pandemic, astrologer Maddie Murphy gathered monthly with friends on a beach for a full moon ritual that involved sharing intentions, pulling oracle cards, and yes, howling. Once surfers even joined in. Of course, your full moon ritual needn't be quite as vocal. The key for believers, Murphy says, is just having a ritual. A full moon ceremony is an invitation to drop into a liminal or mystical space. It creates a container for our intention. There's a chance to tap back into something divine, she says. Below are several astrologer-approved rituals, like salt baths and forgiveness lists, to try out during the full moon if you're so inclined. The ritual can be completed during the day and a half period before and after the full moon. Meditate. Before embarking on your full moon ritual, Boland recommends settling into a meditative state. Take deep breaths, play calming music, and above all, concentrate on what the full moon offers. At the time of the full moon, I let it all go. I make peace with what is and what isn't, and I release any dramas, Boland says. Boland's Moonology book offers a release prayer to use while meditating. Under the glorious full moon, I forgive everything, everyone, every experience, every memory of the past or present that needs forgiveness. I forgive positively everyone. I also forgive myself of past mistakes. The universe is love, and I am forgiven and governed by love alone. Love is now adjusting my life. Realizing this, I abide in peace. Write a forgiveness list. Forgiveness work is the crux of any full moon ritual, according to Boland. Start your full moon ritual by writing down a list of grudges, grievances, and places of hurt that came to you while meditating. Then, Boland says, visualize forgiving each deserving person. Boland emphasizes that forgiveness work is for your benefit. Just because you're forgiving someone doesn't mean that what happened is okay. It just means you're deciding to release that emotional baggage and move on. Otherwise, you're dragging it around, she says. Then start a fire, literally. The next step in a full moon ritual is to destroy that forgiveness list, ideally by burning it. Fire may seem dramatic, but according to Boland, it's an essential component of the ritual. It's important to burn the list because you're putting your negativity out of your body and onto the list, Boland says. You can't imagine how powerful it is. During her virtual full moon ceremonies, Boland lights a fire in her London backyard and burns a forgiveness list to an audience of tens of thousands on Facebook Live. However, a safer option is to burn the piece of paper in the sink or very carefully in the backyard. Take note of what you're grateful for. By this point in the full moon ritual, you've temporarily emptied yourself of resentments. The next step, according to Boland, is to fill the void with gratitude. Spend a moment thinking about someone or something that you're grateful for, Boland says. Then write down a gratitude list in your journal. Gather in a full moon circle. For more of a collective experience, complete your moon rituals alongside others in a gathering known as a moon circle. For Murphy, the presence of others intensifies the already powerful process of letting go. It's bold to say what you want to release out loud. Once you say it out loud, it's already set in motion. Now you have a group of people who are also envisioning it for you, Murphy says. Make moon water. The full moon only lasts for about 3 days. However, astrologers say it's possible to take a bit of its cleansing energy with you by making moon water infused with the light of the full moon. Lisa Stardust, Oprah Daily's resident astrologer and author of Your Saturn Return Survival Guide, explains how. First, fill up a cup or bowl of water and leave it out overnight, beneath the moonlight. Feel free to add herbs, flower petals, or healing crystals to the water. In the morning, the water will be infused with full moon energy, Stardust says. Moon water's uses are flexible. You can use it to wash your face, wash your plants, incorporate it into your bath, or however you see fit. Take a bath. According to astrologers, the full moon is an ideal time to take a relaxing bath. Boland and Stardust recommend adding high-quality Epsom salt to the tub. You're getting rid of all your resentment, bitterness, jealousy, and the salt just draws it out, Boland says. And even though that's not exactly scientifically sound, there are skincare benefits of a salt soak. Pull an oracle card. For Boland, no full moon ritual is complete without an oracle deck. Following the healing and release work, she pulls an oracle card to see how it guides her in the days to come. Unlike tarot cards, oracle cards require no previous knowledge to use. Each card is accompanied by a clear message. With themes ranging from animals to angels, there's an oracle deck for everyone who is interested. Declutter, declutter, declutter. Murphy compares the energy of the full moon to an overflowing closet. It's time to release something to make room for what's come full bloom, she says. While this is a metaphor, Murphy also literally uses the full moon period as a time to clean her home. Charge your crystals. Before going to sleep, place your crystals, tarot decks, and oracle decks on the windowsill. Let them sit overnight under the light of the full moon. The full moon energy is beautiful for recharging and cleansing your crystals, Boland says. Study the astrology of the full moon. Each month, the full moon is in a different astrological sign, changing its effects slightly. According to Boland, the full moon brings out the challenges and issues typically associated with each sign. You can reflect on how you may have embodied those traits this month. If it's a full moon in the sign of Cancer, you may think, have I been insecure lately? If it's in Virgo, you may think, have I been too self-critical, Boland says. Last but not least, take it easy. Finally, astrologers say the full moon is not the time to start new projects. Rather, if you can, it's a moment for sitting back and relaxing. Don't feel rushed to start something new, Murphy says. The full moon is all about completion energy. Our next article by Susan Shapiro is titled, A Zoom with a View. I had been a college writing professor for 25 years when the coronavirus forced us online in March of 2020. I feared the intimacy of crafting and reading aloud first-person essays wouldn't translate digitally, and never had my technophobia seem more justified. At my first online class, I was greeted by an image of a Barbie instead of my student's face. I was Zoom-bombed with techno music and once was kicked off my own class for 16 minutes. Within weeks of the initial shutdown, I was heartbroken to see my Manhattan undergrad and graduate students suddenly sick with no medical insurance, thrown out of their dorm rooms and fighting to return to their homes during chaotic airport bans with ever-changing rules. They had paid tuition and needed the credits to get their degrees. Technophobic or not, I decided I wouldn't let them down. I dressed up, did my hair and makeup, and commuted to my living room. Usually our class goal was to write and sell a great piece by the last session. My signature assignment to find literary gold fast was to ask for 3 pages confessing your most humiliating secret. I promised my students that writing was a way to turn their worst traumas into the most beautiful art. Now that visiting editors wanted essays about how people were surviving the virus, we turned to the pain of the pandemic. I got COVID twice, but nobody cares, a student threw out. Anti-Asian violence makes me afraid to go outside, said another. Another student, a Michigan teacher born with a deformed jaw, admitted she preferred wearing a mask because it made her less self-conscious. A gay student confessed he'd been the victim of homophobia, xenophobia, and food insecurity. These tales soon became poignant published pieces, transforming obstacles into small triumphs we shared on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. As spring and summer courses remained virtual, I received emails from current and former students in distress whom I'd kept in touch with, as well as social media friends, fans, and followers wanting guidance. The vulnerable essays I'd posted inspired others to share their own struggles. A 17-year-old whose uncle died from COVID worried about finishing high school on his computer in his family's cramped West Coast apartment. After suffering a miscarriage, a woman in England dreaded subpar health care women of color like her received. A mom in Queens with complications from post-mastectomy implants had her corrective surgery postponed. Another was put off by newspaper and magazine articles blaming people of color for not getting vaccinated. A North Carolina mom was petrified that the social isolation was making her 8-year-old suicidal. A single dad in Pennsylvania tried to help his 89-year-old British Indian mom through a medical crisis 3,500 miles away. At the university where I taught, I was allowed seats only for the 20 pupils officially enrolled. But as computer courses became commonplace, I launched private Zoom classes on my own where I could fit in many more faces, and it was my choice who was invited. The global medical emergency had at first made me feel powerless. During Black Lives Matter protests and waves of anti-Asian and anti-Semitic harassment, I'd been unsure how to be an ally. Now I could welcome hundreds of pupils who couldn't afford tuition to audit my courses for free. Those who were disabled or who had commuting and childcare issues could participate more easily. Seeing inside each other's homes added comedy and transparency. Plus, I could mute the guy loudly chomping potato chips. I made exceptions for odd-hour emails, texts, or calls when an editor's interest meant a debut clip in a national paper and $500 for someone who'd been out of work for a year. With no geographic limitations, more publishing luminaries across the country could join our teleconference sessions. Class rosters, previously filled with mostly white Manhattanites, became beautifully multicultural. Writers in Vietnam, Malaysia, Hong Kong, and India woke up at 6 a.m. to log on while night owls from Italy, France, Brussels, and Egypt stayed up past midnight. With fresh New York Times and Washington Post bylines, the California high schooler was offered and accepted a full scholarship to Stanford University. The masked Michigan teacher sold her debut novel. A single mother exposing the racism she'd suffered in America landed a six-figure memoir to Penguin Random House and dazzled at ebook events we did together. In a form of gratitude that teachers treasure but rarely get, three students thanked me with articles about my online teaching. Instead of Zoom fatigue, I had Zoom zest. To encourage my students, I've often quoted my addiction therapist who told me, "To stay happy and healthy, you should lead the least secretive life you can." Zooming into my classroom, I learned that sharing our struggles is still the best way to fight isolation and uncertainty. While the health crisis continues to loom, I'll keep my focus on my laptop's silver lining. I'm grateful for this fascinating window connecting me to the outside world. Susan Shapiro is the best-selling author of several books her family hates, including Unhooked, Five Men Who Broke My Heart, The Forgiveness Tour, and the writing guides The Byline Bible and The Book Bible. She teaches her popular Instant Gratification Takes Too Long writing and publishing classes at the New School, NYU, and privately online. Our next article by Stephanie Farrington is titled How One Young Man Came Out to His Evangelical Mom. Parker Cunningham, a 32-year-old cisgender gay man, grew up in an evangelical home in Oklahoma. A state LGBTQ positive advocacy group Human Rights Campaign, or HRC, identifies as high priority for securing even basic rights for its queer residents. But years before Parker began grappling with the legal ramifications of being gay in the red state, his church continuously hurled toxic dogmas at him about his future damnation should he act on his most tender affections for other boys. "We had messages from the pulpit against homosexuality," he says. "A rainbow flag above a church here can bring death threats, spray paint, and protests," he points out, adding that the first church to take that risk was a topic of disapproval within his own congregation. He also had the difficult task of managing his ultra-conservative religious mother, Sarah, and her reaction to his queerness. He had to come out several times before she finally accepted the truth about his orientation. Today, Sarah is a staunch ally and even runs her own LGBTQ positive advocacy group called Free Mom Hugs, which she launched in 2015 after attending a gay pride festival to give emotional support to LGBTQ positive people who've been abandoned by their families. "Anyone who made eye contact with me, I'd offer them a free mom," she says, noting that the organization now has chapters in every state and is going international this year. Once Parker overcame what he thought was his biggest hurdle, gaining the love and acceptance of his family, he became aware of a new challenge. His precarious legal status as a gay man in Oklahoma, where it's not against the law to discriminate against local citizens based on gender and sexual orientation. You could lose your job, even housing in most locales, if a person in power isn't an ally, or rather, is an outright enemy. To amplify the critical importance of passing the Equality Act, a bill that would federally prohibit discrimination on the basis of sex, gender, and orientation in all 50 states, the HRC designed and recently flew outside its headquarters in D.C. an American flag missing 29 of its 50 stars to call attention to the states, including Oklahoma, lacking comprehensive protections for LGBTQ positive people. In February 2021, the Equality Act passed in the House of Representatives, and now the rights of millions of LGBTQ positive people rest in the hands of the Senate. To discuss and illuminate the importance of this bill and the continued power and significance of coming out, Oprah Daily sat down with Parker and Sarah to hear their story. Parker, when did you start to sense your queer difference? I think really just in contrast to the background that is evangelical central Oklahoma where I live. Kids like me just kind of stick out a little bit more than others. Sarah, as a child, did you have a sense that Parker might be gay? The first time I recall thinking, okay, something is different, is seeing him come downstairs in one of my dresses and a pair of high heels. He was dancing around in the kitchen and just had this expression of joy. I'd never seen that expression. He danced until his hair was wet with sweat and a dress, and he slept with the dress in his room with the heels. He was so happy. How old was he? I think five, but you know, we raised our children in a very conservative evangelical church where we absorb this idea that it's wrong. So any type of conversation he tried to have with me, I thought it was a phase. I thought something would change through the power of the Holy Spirit or God's word, or that praise and worship music would make him normal. Again, he tried to have the conversation several times, but I wasn't ready to accept it. When did you officially come out to your mother? I really spent my whole life coming out. We say that a lot, but it's really true. I came out to her many times, either by accident or by her finding a note to one of my friends while she was doing my laundry or through my search history on the computer. Accidentally, over and over. But when I was 21, I had met someone and was just like, this is who I am. This is what I'm doing. You are welcome to come with me on this journey, but you've had that option for a really long time. Sarah, can you share how the conversation with Parker went when he came out to you at 21? Well, we were at lunch and he said, Mom, I met someone and I need you to be okay about it. It was around the holidays and it was during the work week, so we left our work to meet for lunch. There's definitely a reason I picked a public place, Parker says. I needed it to be a quiet, non-stressful area because I knew how she was going to react. I felt like a napkin who was just soaking up this message, like, what just happened, says Sarah. Because it was official, like, welcome to reality. You have a gay son. I'm a woman of faith. What the hell does this even look like? And I went into a deep depression. I behaved very badly. It was not good around my house at all. How long did that last before you reached the other side? Well, I stayed in my bed for quite a while, but there were pivotal moments where Parker would come into our room and say, Mom, are you going to be okay? And I would say, yeah, I just need to figure this out. And he'd say, well, I need you to understand that I've been your son for 21 years, and now I need you to be my mom. It was things like that where I had to re-examine everything that I believed and look for resources. I thought I was the only mom in the world with these crazy thoughts in my head that my son was going to hell and to burn for eternity. I was just frozen in that place. It took probably a whole year before we were able to have legitimate, authentic conversations, Parker says. Sarah, what helped you get to the other side to finally accept or even celebrate your son? Well, I say that it's a journey that took us from the church to the pride parade. I started journaling, writing what became my book, How We Sleep at Night, A Mother's Memoir. I found a private online Facebook group for moms with gay kids, and we kind of pour out all our fears and frustrations and anxieties in that group rather than putting them on our children. They were women just like me. We all had the same story of feeling alienated from our families and our church homes. I started learning about how my straight son has more rights than my gay son and just really getting educated about the history of the gay community, Stonewall, all of those things, and finally seeing Parker happy and living authentically and meeting his friends. At its headquarters in D.C., the HRC unveiled an American flag, which they're calling the Reality Flag. It has only 21 stars on it, leaving out the 29 states that do not provide equality for all Americans, to underline the critical importance of passing the Equality Act. Can you tell me what it means to you? It moved me beyond anything because what greater symbol of America than the American flag, Sarah says. To see the 29 stars that have been removed, representing states that do not offer equality for families and children like mine, it was quite the visual. You know, since 2016, that symbol has been weaponized against me in a lot of ways, like a lot of Bible verses have been used against me, Parker says. It's this good thing that also excluded me. It wasn't until I saw the flag with the 29 stars missing that I felt like I was a part of it. With marriage equality, 60% of Americans now believe that LGBTQ people are completely covered, but we can still be discriminated against from entering a grocery store, our schools, or our doctor's office. It's reclaiming the freedom of living in America and having safety where you live and where you work and where you go to school, Sarah says. Parents should never have to worry about those things with their child, gay or straight. It's a campaign meant not only to educate, but to raise awareness about the missing freedoms for LGBTQ plus people. It will inspire people to come together and take action. Our next article by Lisa Barr is titled, How One Woman's Burnout Sparked a Terrifying Medical Emergency. It was 3:14 a.m., Sunday morning. I was wide awake, obsessing, read, panicking. My book edits were due the next day, and I had another 50 pages to go. But this wasn't just work stress. A fight with a friend, coupled with family conflict that triggered deep pain from my childhood, left me feeling hurt and depleted. And two of my three 20-something daughters had their own issues going on and needed me to focus on their problems. All of that, plus a list of everyday to-dos that seemed to grow by the minute, was swirling in my head. I felt as if I were drowning. I couldn't breathe. I got up because I could no longer lie in bed, twisting and turning with my thoughts. Plus, there was so much to do. I let the dog out, threw in a load of laundry, made a cup of coffee, and immediately got to work finishing my book edits. As I was typing, I felt my throat tighten and started worrying I might be having a panic attack. After a half hour or so of waiting it out, I put the clothes in the dryer and, now truly exhausted, climbed back into bed. I curled up to my sleeping husband, and that led to a little something-something. Sorry, kids, but you'll see soon why that's not an overshare. Then my hubby and I got up, got dressed, and headed out for breakfast to our favorite little French cafe, our Sunday morning go-to whenever our daughters are in their respective apartments, not staying with us as they had for long stretches during COVID. The panic attack I feared had never materialized, but I still felt off as though I were in a fog. I froze at the passenger side of the car. "Why are you just standing there?" my husband asked. I didn't know. I felt confused. "Where are we going?" "Seriously?" he stared at me. "Where we always go." "Okay." But I didn't move. I couldn't put it together. Couldn't remember where we always go. I felt displaced, a little scared. "What's the deal, honey? Get in the car." "Where are we going?" I asked again, my voice tightening. "To the cafe. Are you okay?" I wasn't. My husband tells me that this little combo repeated 5 times in 5 minutes. He opened my car door, assisted me inside, and started asking rapid-fire questions. When he saw my blank face, he stopped himself mid-interrogation and called my brother, a doctor, who started quizzing me through the car speaker. Same questions. I didn't know any of the answers. But I knew that something was terribly wrong and I had no control over it, nor the floaty feeling I was experiencing. "Get her to the hospital now," my brother told my husband. "I'm calling her in." "Wait," I shouted, "where are we going?" According to my husband's play-by-play of the day, the ensuing frenzy went down like this. The doctors in the emergency team thought I was having an aneurysm or a stroke. I was asked my name, the day of the week, to recount events that happened within the last hour. I couldn't provide any of the answers. Weirdly, I could recall the name of my best friend from grade school, my phone number growing up, my first boy I kissed playing Spin the Bottle decades ago. But the day of the week? I couldn't come up with it then, but now I'll never forget. July 4th, 2021. For me, the entire day is gone like a fireworks explosion that just petered out. I aced my CAT scan, MRI, exam after exam. The doctor said my brain appeared to be in great shape, even younger than my years. No sign of stroke or aneurysm. But I was acutely aware that I was flunking some kind of life test, losing me. The faces around me began to blend and blur like I was on a train, staring out at passing images. I kept asking my husband, "Am I okay?" And he kept lying, "Yes." Finally, I was admitted to the hospital for round-the-clock observation. I met with the top neurologist from another hospital via what's called a telestroke, a virtual examination of a suspected stroke patient. He said, "Lisa, I'm going to ask you a series of questions, but I'm sure you're not going to remember any of this. I know exactly what's going on here." It turned out I had a condition called transient global amnesia. TGA is a neurological transitory syndrome that causes a temporary but near total disruption of short-term memory. My mind was only able to retain something for a few seconds, and then poof, whatever I was thinking vanished. In simple terms, my overloaded mind blew a fuse. Ironically, although I couldn't tell you what happened to me 5 minutes ago, I remembered watching a Grey's Anatomy episode where a patient had TGA years earlier. Apparently, I told everyone at the hospital who would listen, doctors, nurses, family members, the cleaning staff, about that show over and over at least 100 times. My husband finally made me a TGA cheat sheet to explain why I was in the hospital and to save himself from the same questions on repeat. It read, July 4th, girls are okay. You have transient global amnesia. You are in Lake Forest Hospital. You'll be fine. CT scan is normal. No aneurysm. He swears that I read the cheat sheet every 4 minutes for 12 straight hours and said the exact same thing. Oh, honey, you wrote this for me? That is so sweet. Despite the note in my hand reassuring me that our daughters were fine, I kept asking, are the girls okay? Followed by, did I get my book edits done in time? Those were my two biggest worries. Now, half a year later, we joke about what he was really thinking. Am I going to have to live with this whack job for the rest of my life? But that first night in the hospital, he was scared. He climbed into the single bed and held me, praying that I would return to him. The doctor said that TGA, which most often occurs in people between the ages of 50 and 70, causes memory loss that could last for up to 24 hours. My short-term memory began trickling in at the 12th hour. I would later learn that my word retrieval could take up to 6 months or more, a kind of curse for a writer. I still say things like, I would really love some of that purplish liquid, you know, the kind that comes in a genie bottle with fermented grapes. And my husband will say, oh, you mean wine. But for the most part, I'm all right. Now that I am, the episode seems almost as funny as it was frightening. But both then and now, my main question was, how did this happen? I put my investigative journalism skills to work researching TGA and came to understand that most likely I brought this shit show on myself. Dissecting the week leading up to it, I checked many of the TGA trigger boxes. Excessive stress, insomnia, anxiety, trauma, even sex. All of them are stimulants, plus scientists now think that brain spasms caused by physical exertion, emotional pain, or sex can trigger TGA. Episodes often take place shortly after orgasm. The good news is that TGA resolves itself and only recurs in less than 10% of cases. But that doesn't mean I'm going back to my old life unchanged. TGA made it clear that I was living too intensely. My normal MO is to overdo it, then take it one notch higher. I see now that my mind and body needed to slow down, but I ignored all the neon signs. Irritability, no sleep, high anxiety. And instead I stepped on the gas, and I crashed. Now I'm making taking care of myself a priority. I've had multiple post-TGA appointments with neurologists, more brain tests, and an upcoming all-day memory test scheduled at the end of this month. In the past, I would put my kids, work, husband, everyone else first, canceling necessary doctor's appointments if someone or something else demanded my attention. Now I remind myself that if I ignore my health needs, it will come back to bite me. Most importantly, when I start overdoing things, I remind myself, be careful. Don't forget that you did this to you. Don't do it again. Go take a break. I now force myself to turn off the damn phone or leave it behind when I'm enjoying downtime. Reading, taking a walk, going on a bike ride. I cut out the toxic people in my life. And to be honest, that part was the hardest and the most liberating. I'm also learning, teaching myself how not to be as sensitive. How to say no. How to inform my type of get-it-done personality that it's okay to be an A-minus sometimes or even a B-plus. How to accept not always having to be the best mom, wife, writer, friend, and put me before them when necessary. How to admit that I can't be all things to all people all the time, or bam, I will self-destruct once again. I'm not sharing this information because I want to expose my vulnerabilities. I'm very private when it comes to my mental and physical health, probably because of a misguided belief that showing any sort of weakness is kryptonite to my perceived superpowers. It's part of my I can do it all complex. But I realize that so many women around me also live their lives in fifth gear. I'm hoping that my TGA experience can serve as a cautionary tale of what happens when you spread yourself too thin, ignoring your own needs. that by doing so, I might encourage others to make the hard changes before burning out. I now start off my day with just me. I wake up before my family, make a great cup of coffee, sit on a big comfy chair facing my backyard window, and free associate, listening to the sound of my own thoughts and inner voice asking, what do I want out of this day? By slowing down, breathing, making more time for yoga and nature walks in between all my life demands, I'm creating space, creativity, and more room in my overcrowded mind of to-dos. TGA was terrifying, but also it was a gift, a loud and clear wake-up call. I'm doing the work to change lifelong patterns. You're now looking at a, what's that term? You know, the thing where you are trying hard to be better at something because it's good for you and you're not quite there, but almost. Work in progress, my husband calls out from the couch. Yes, that's me. We'll end this week with Oprah's weekly intention. What to look for in a chosen family. According to Gail King, having a chosen family isn't just for those who don't have solid bonds with biological relatives. We can all use more support and love in our lives. Here she shares what to look for in the people you hold near and dear. I am very lucky in that I have always had close, healthy relationships with my family. I used to talk to my mom every single day about everything and about nothing. Now I talk to favorite daughter Kirby every day. They say that blood is thicker than water, but that may not always be a good thing. I have friends who have difficult relationships with their family. If your relatives are toxic and cause you emotional distress, I don't think you should put up with that. I've watched my friends have a hard time setting boundaries with these family members. They're hung up on the idea of what family is supposed to be rather than looking at what they really have. Having a chosen family can help soothe those feelings you may be missing with your actual family. But creating a chosen family is also important for people who have wonderful biological families. Research shows us that the most important thing in life is to have good relationships. People who have them live longer and are happier. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.